During prison lockdowns, there was at least one a month. Morris would lie on his bunk with his hands crossed behind his head and think about the fourth Jimmy Gold novel, wondering if it contained the redemption he had so longed for after closing The Runner Slows Down. Was it possible Jimmy had regained his old hopes and dreams? His old fire? If only he'd had two more days with it. Even one. Although he doubted if even John Rothstein could have made a thing like that believable. Based on Morris's own observations, his parents being his prime exemplars, when the fire went out, it usually went out for good. Yet some people did change. He remembered once bringing up that possibility to Andy Halliday while they were having one of their many lunch hour discussions. This was at the Happy Cup, just down the street from Grissom Books, where Andy worked, and not long after Morris had left City College, deciding what pass for higher education there was fucking pointless. Nixon changed, Morris said. The old commie hater opened trade relations with China, and Lyndon Johnson pushed the Civil Rights Bill through Congress. If an old racist hyena like him could change his spots, I suppose anything is possible.
Politicians, Andy sniffed as at a bad smell. He was a skinny crew-cut fellow, only a few years older than Morris. They change out of expediency, not idealism. Ordinary people don't even do that. They can't. If they refuse to behave, they're punished. Then after punishment, they say, okay, yes, sir, and get with the program like the good little drones they are. Look at what happened to the Vietnam War protesters. Most of them are now living middle-class lives, fat, happy, and voting Republican. Those who refuse to knuckle under are in jail or on the run, like Catherine Ann Power.
How can you call Jimmy Gold ordinary? Morris cried. Andy had given him a patronizing look.
Oh, please. His entire story is an epic journey out of exceptionalism. The purpose of American culture is to create a norm, Morris. That means that extraordinary people must be leveled, and it happens to Jimmy. He ends up working in advertising, for God's sake, and what greater agent of the norm is there in this fucked-up country? It's Rothstein's main point, he shook his head, if you're looking for optimism, buy a Harlequin romance.
Morris thought Andy was basically arguing for the sake of argument. A zealot's eyes burned behind his nerdy horn rims, but even then Morris was getting the man's measure. His zeal was for books as objects, not for the stories and ideas inside them. They had lunch together two or three times a week, usually at the Cup, sometimes across the street from Grissom's on the benches in Government Square. It was during one of these lunches that Andrew Halliday first mentioned the persistent rumor that John Rothstein had continued to write, but that his will specified all the work be burned upon his death. No, Morris had cried, genuinely wounded. That could never happen. Could it?
Andy shrugged. If it's in the will, anything he's written since he dropped out of sight is as good as ashes.
You're just making it up.
The stuff about the will might just be a rumor, I grant you that, but it's well accepted in bookstore circles that Rothstein never stopped writing.
Bookstore circles, Morris had said doubtfully.
We have our own grapevine, Morris. Rothstein's housekeeper does his shopping, okay? Not just groceries, either. Once every month or 6 weeks, she goes into White River Books in Berlin, which is the closest town of any size, to pick up books he's ordered by phone. She's told the people who work there that he writes every day from 6 in the morning until 2 in the afternoon. The owner told some other dealers at the Boston Book Fair, and the word got around.
Holy shit, Morris had breathed. This conversation had taken place in June of 1976. Rothstein's last published story, The Perfect Banana Pie, had been published in 1960. If what Andy was saying was true, it meant that John Rothstein had been piling up fresh fiction for 16 years. At even 800 words a day, that added up to. Morris couldn't begin to do the math in his head, but it was a lot.
Holy shit is right, Andy said.
If he really wants all that burned when he dies, he's crazy.
Most writers are.
Andy had leaned forward, smiling as if what he said next were a joke. Maybe it was, to him at least.
Here's what I think. Someone should mount a rescue mission. Maybe you, Morris. After all, you're his number one fan.
Not me, Morris said, not after what he did to Jimmy Gold.
Cool it, guy. You can't blame a man for following his muse.
Sure I can.
Then steal him, Andy said, still smiling. Call it theft as a protest on behalf of English literature. Bring him to me. I'll sit on him a while and sell him. If they're not senile gibberish, they might fetch as much as $1 million. I'll split with you. 50-50, even Steven.
They'd catch us.
Don't think so, Andy Halliday had replied. There are ways.
How long would you have to wait before you could sell them?
A few years, Andy had replied, waving his hand as if he were talking about a couple of hours. 5, maybe. A month later, heartily sick of living on Sycamore Street and haunted by the idea of all those manuscripts, Morris packed his beat-up Volvo and drove to Boston, where he got hired by a contractor building a couple of housing developments out in the burbs. The work had nearly killed him at first, but he had muscled up a little, not that he was ever going to look like Duck Duckworth, and after that he'd done okay. He even made a couple of friends, Freddie Dow and Curtis Rogers. Once he called Andy. Could you really sell unpublished Rothstein manuscripts?
No doubt, Andy Halliday said. Not right away, as I believe I said, but so what? We're young, he's not. Time would be on our side.
Yes, and that would include time to read everything Rothstein had written since The Perfect Banana Pie. Profit, even $500,000, was incidental. I am not a mercenary, Morris told himself. I am not interested in the golden buck. That shit don't mean shit. Give me enough to live on, sort of like a grant, and I'll be happy. I am a scholar. On the weekends, he began driving up to Talbot Corners, New Hampshire. In 1977, he began taking Curtis and Freddie with him. Gradually, a plan began to take shape. A simple one, the best kind. Your basic smash and grab. Philosophers have debated the meaning of life for centuries, rarely coming to the same conclusion. Morris studied the subject himself over the years of his incarceration, but his inquiries were practical rather than cosmic. He wanted to know the meaning of life in a legal sense. What he found was pretty schizo. In some states, life meant exactly that. You were supposedly in until you died with no possibility of parole. In some states, parole was considered after as little as 2 years. In others, it was 5, 7, 10, or 15. In Nevada, parole was granted or not based on a complicated point system. By the year 2001, the average life sentence of a man in the American prison system was 30 years and 4 months. In the state where Morris was stacking time, lawmakers had created their own arcane definition of life, one based on demographics. In 1979, when Morris was convicted, the average American male lived to the age of 70. Morris was 23 at the time, therefore he could consider his debt to society paid in 47 years. Unless, that is, he were granted parole. He became eligible the first time in 1990. Cora Ann Hooper appeared at the hearing. She was wearing a neat blue suit. Her graying hair was pulled back in a bun so tight it screeched. She held a large black purse in her lap. She recounted how Morris Bellamy had grabbed her as she passed the alley beside Shooter's Tavern and told her of his intention to rip off a piece. She told the 5-member parole board how he had punched her and broken her nose when she managed to trigger the police alert device she kept in her purse. She told the board about the reek of alcohol on his breath and how he had gouged her stomach with his nails when he ripped off her underwear. She told them how Morris was still choking me and hurting me with his organ when Officer Ellington arrived and pulled him off.
She told the board that she had attempted suicide in 1980 and was still under the care of a psychiatrist. She told the board that she was better since accepting Jesus Christ as her personal savior, but she still had nightmares. No, she told the board, she had never married. The thought of sex gave her panic attacks. Parole was not granted. Several reasons were given on the green sheet passed to him through the bars that evening, but the one at the top was clearly the PB's major consideration. Victim states she is still suffering.
Bitch. Hooper appeared again in 1995 and again in 2000. In 95, she wore the same blue suit. In the millennium year, by then she had gained at least 40 pounds, she wore a brown one. In 2005, the suit was gray, and a large white cross hung on the growing shelf of her bosom. She held what appeared to be the same large black purse in her lap at each appearance. Presumably her police alert was inside, maybe a can of mace as well. She was not summoned to these hearings. She volunteered and told her story.
Parole was not granted. Major reason given on the green sheet. Victim states she is still suffering.
Shit don't mean shit, Morris told himself. Shit don't mean shit. Maybe not, but God, he wished he'd killed her.
By the time of his third turndown, Morris's work as a writer was much in demand. He was, in the small world of Waynesville, a best-selling author. He wrote love letters to wives and girlfriends. He wrote letters to the children of inmates, a few of which confirmed the reality of Santa Claus in touching prose. He wrote job applications for prisoners whose release dates were coming up. He wrote themes for prisoners taking online college courses or working to get their GEDs. He was no jailhouse lawyer, but he did write letters to real lawyers on behalf of inmates from time to time, cogently explaining each case at hand and laying out the basis for appeal. In some cases, lawyers were impressed by these letters and, mindful of the money to be made from wrongful imprisonment suits that were successful, came on board. As DNA became of overriding importance in the appeals process, he wrote often to Barry Scheck and Peter Neufeld, the founders of the Innocence Project. One of those letters ultimately led to the release of an auto mechanic and part-time thief named Charles Roberson, who had been in Waynesville for 27 years. Roberson got his freedom. Morris got Roberson's eternal gratitude and nothing else, unless you counted his own growing reputation, and that was far from nothing. It had been a long time since he had been raped. In 2004, Morris wrote his best letter ever, laboring over four drafts to get it exactly right. This letter was to Cora Ann Hooper. In it, he told her that he lived with terrible remorse for what he had done and promised that if he were granted parole, he would spend the rest of his life atoning for his one violent act committed during an alcohol-induced blackout. I attend AA meetings four times a week here, he wrote, and now sponsor half a dozen recovering alcoholics and drug addicts. I would continue this work on the outside at the St. Patrick's Halfway House on the north side. I had a spiritual awakening, Ms. Hooper, and have allowed Jesus into my life. You will understand how important this is, because I know you have also accepted Christ as your Savior. Forgive us our trespasses, he said, as we forgive those who trespass against us. Won't you please forgive my trespass against you? I am no longer the man who hurt you so badly that night. I have had a soul conversion. I pray that you respond to my letter. 10 days later, his prayer for a response was answered. There was no return address on the envelope, but C.A. Hooper had been printed neatly on the back flap. Morris didn't need to tear it open. Some screw in the front office assigned the duty of checking inmate mail had already taken care of that. Inside was a single sheet of deckle-edged stationery. In the upper right corner and the lower left, fluffy kittens played with gray balls of twine. There was no salutation, A single line had been printed halfway down the page.
"I hope you rot in there."
The bitch appeared at his hearing the following year, legs now clad in support hose, ankles slopping over her sensible shoes. She was like some overweight, vengeful swallow returning to the prison version of Capistrano. She once more told her story, and parole was once more not granted. Morris had been a model prisoner, and now there was just a single reason given on the inmate green sheet.
Victim states she is still suffering.
Morris assured himself that shit did not mean shit and went back to his cell. Not exactly a penthouse apartment, just 6x8, but at least there were books. Books were escape. Books were freedom. He lay on his cot imagining how pleasant it would be to have 15 minutes alone with Cora Ann Hooper and a power nailer. Morris was by then working in the library, which was a wonderful change for the better. The guards didn't much care how he spent his paltry budget, so it was no problem to subscribe to the American Bibliographer's newsletter. He also got a number of catalogs from rare book dealers around the country, which were free. Books by John Rothstein came up for sale frequently, offered at ever steeper prices. Morris found himself rooting for this the way some prisoners rooted for sports teams. The value of most writers went down after they died, but a fortunate few trended upward. Rothstein had become one of those. Once in a while, a signed Rothstein showed up in one of the catalogs. In the 2007 edition of Bauman's Christmas Catalog, a copy of The Runner signed to Harper Lee, a so-called association copy, went for $17,000. Morris also kept an eye on the city newspaper during his years of incarceration, and then, as the 21st century wrought its technological changes, various city websites. The land between Sycamore Street and Birch Street was still mired in that unending legal suit, which was just the way Morris liked it. He would get out eventually, and his trunk would be there, with the roots of that overhanging tree wrapped firmly around it. That the worth of those notebooks must by now be astronomical mattered less and less to him.
Once he had been young, and he supposed he would have enjoyed all the things young men chased after when their legs were strong and their balls were tight. Travel and women, cars and women, big homes like the ones in Sugar Heights and women. Now he rarely even dreamed of such things, and the last woman with whom he'd had sex remained largely instrumental in keeping him locked up. The irony wasn't lost on him, but that was okay.
The things of the world fell by the wayside. You lost your speed and your eyesight and your fucking electric boogaloo, but literature was eternal, and that was what was waiting for him. A lost geography as yet seen by no eye but its creators. If he didn't get to see that geography himself until he was 70, so be it. There was the money, too. All those cash envelopes. Not a fortune by any means, but a nice little nest egg. "I have something to live for," he told himself. How many men in here can say that, especially once their thighs go flabby and their cocks only stand up when they need to pee? Morris wrote several times to Andy Halliday, who now did have his own shop. Morris knew that from American Bibliographer's newsletter. He also knew that his old pal had gotten into trouble at least once for trying to sell a stolen copy of James Agee's most famous book, but had skated. Too bad. Morris would have dearly loved to welcome that cologne-wearing homo to Waynesville. There were plenty of bad boys here who would have been all too willing to put a hurt on him for Maury Bellamy. Just a daydream, though. Even if Andy had been convicted, it probably would have been just a fine. At worst, he would have gotten sent to the country club at the west end of the state where the white-collar thieves went. None of Morris's letters to Andy were answered. In 2010, his personal swallow once more returned to Capistrano wearing a black suit again as if dressed for her own funeral, which will be soon if she doesn't lose some weight, Morris thought nastily. Cora Ann Hooper's jowls now hung down at the sides of her neck in fleshy flapjacks. Her eyes were all but buried in pouches of fat. Her skin was sallow. She had replaced the black purse with a blue one, but everything else was the same. Bad dreams, endless therapy, life ruined thanks to the horrible beast who sprang out of the alley that night, so on and so forth, blah, blah, blah.
Aren't you over that lousy rape yet? Morris thought. Aren't you ever going to move on?
Morris went back to his cell thinking, shit don't mean shit. It don't mean fucking shit. That was the year he turned 55. One day, in March of 2014, a turnkey came to get Morris from the library where he was sitting behind the main desk reading American Pastoral for the third time. It was by far Philip Roth's best book, in Morris's opinion. The turnkey told him he was wanted in admin. What for? Morris asked, getting up. Trips to admin were not ordinarily good news. Usually it was cops wanting you to roll on somebody and threatening you with all kinds of dark shit if you refused to cooperate. PB hearing.
No, Morris said. It's a mistake. The board doesn't hear me again until next year.
I only do what they tell me, the turnkey said. If you don't want me to give you a mark, find somebody to take the desk and get the lead out of your ass.
The parole board, now 3 men and 3 women, was convened in the conference room. Philip Downs, the board's legal counsel, made lucky 7. He read a letter from Cora Ann Hooper. It was an amazing letter. The bitch had cancer. That was good news. But what followed was even better. She was dropping all objections to Morris Bellamy's parole. She said she was sorry she had waited so long. Downs then read a letter from the Midwest Culture and Arts Center, locally known as the MAC. They had hired many Waynesville parolees over the years and were willing to take Morris Bellamy on as a part-time file clerk and computer operator starting in May, should parole be granted.
In light of your clean record over the past 35 years and in light of Ms. Hooper's letter, Downs said, I felt that putting the subject of your parole before the board a year early was the right thing to do. Ms. Hooper informs us that she doesn't have much time, and I'm sure she'd like to get closure on this matter. He turned to them. How say you, ladies and gentlemen?
Morris already knew how the ladies and gentlemen would say. Otherwise, he never would have been brought here. The vote was 6-0 in favor of granting him parole.
How do you feel about that, Morris?
Downs asked. Morris, ordinarily good with words, was too stunned to say anything, but he didn't have to. He burst into tears. 2 months later, after the obligatory pre-release counseling and shortly before his job at the MAC was scheduled to begin, he walked through Gate A and back into the free world. In his pocket were his earnings from 35 years in the dye house, the furniture workshop, and the library. It amounted to $2,700 and change. The Rothstein notebooks were finally within reach.
Part 2. Old Pals. 1.
Kermit William Hodges, plain old Bill to his friends, drives along Airport Road with the windows rolled down and the radio turned up, singing along with Dylan's It Takes a Lot to Laugh, It Takes a Train to Cry. He's 66, no spring chicken, but he looks pretty good for a heart attack survivor. He's lost 40 pounds since the vapor lock and has quit eating the junk food that was killing him a little with each mouthful. "Do you want to live to see 75?" the cardiologist asked him. This was at his first full checkup a couple of weeks after the pacemaker went in. If you do, give up the pork rinds and donuts. Make friends with salads. As advice goes, it's not up there with love thy neighbor as thyself, but Hodges has taken it to heart. There's a salad in a white paper bag on the seat beside him. You'll have plenty of time to eat it with Dasani to wash it down if Oliver Madden's plane is on time. And if Madden comes at all. Holly Gibney has assured him that Madden is already on the way. She got his flight plan from a computer site called Air Tracker, but it's always possible that Madden will smell something downwind and head in another direction. He has been out there doing dirt for quite some time now, and guys like that have very educated sniffers. Hodges passes the feeder road to the main terminals and short-term parking and continues on, following the signs that read Air Freight and Signature Air and Thomas Zane Aviation. He turns in at this last. It's an independent, fixed-based operator, huddled, almost literally, in the shadow of the much bigger Signature Air FBO next door. There are weeds sprouting from the cracked asphalt of the little parking lot, which is empty except for the front row. That has been reserved for a dozen or so rental cars. In the middle of the economies and mid-sizes and hulking above them is a black Lincoln Navigator with smoked glass windows. Hodges takes this as a good sign. His man does like to go in style, a common trait among dirtbags. And although his man may wear $1,000 suits, he is still very much a dirtbag. Hodges bypasses the parking lot and pulls into the turnaround out front, stopping in front of a sign reading, Loading and Unloading Only. Hodges hopes to be loading. He checks his watch. 11:15. He thinks of his mother saying, You must always arrive early on important occasions, Billy, and the memory makes him smile. He takes his iPhone off his belt and calls the office. It rings just once.
Finders Keepers, Holly says.
She always says the name of the company, no matter who's calling. It's one of her little tics. She has many little tics.
Are you there, Bill? Are you at the airport? Are you?
Little tics aside, this Holly Gibney is very different from the one he first met 4 years ago when she came to town for her aunt's funeral, and the changes are all for the better. Although she's sneaking the occasional cigarette again, he has smelled them on her breath. I'm here, he says. Tell me I'm going to get lucky.
Luck has nothing to do with it, she says. Air Tracker is a very good website. You might like to know that there are currently 6,412 flights in U.S. airspace. Isn't that interesting?
Totally fascinating. Is Madden's ETA still 11:30?
11:37, to be exact. You left your skim milk on your desk. I put it back in the fridge. Skim milk goes over very rapidly on hot days, you know. Even in an air-conditioned environment, which this is. Now.
She nagged Hodges into the air conditioning. Holly is a very good nagger when she puts her mind to it. Chug-a-lug, Holly, he says. I have a Dasani.
No, thank you. I'm drinking my Diet Coke. Barbara Robinson called. She wanted to talk to you. She was all serious. I told her she could call you later this afternoon, or you'd call her. Uncertainty creeps into her voice. Was that all right? I thought you'd want your phone available for the time being.
That's fine, Holly. Did she say what she was all serious about?
No.
Call her back and tell her I'll be in touch as soon as this is wrapped up.
You'll be careful, won't you?
I always am.
Although Holly knows that's not exactly true, he damn near got himself, Barbara's brother, Jerome, and Holly herself blown to Kingdom Come 4 years ago. And Holly's cousin was blown up, although that came earlier.
Hodges, who had been more than halfway to in love with Janie Patterson, still mourns her. And still blames himself. These days he takes care of himself, for himself, but he also does it because he believes it's what Janie would have wanted. He tells Holly to hold the fort and returns his iPhone to the place on his belt where he used to carry his Glock before he became a debt ret. In retirement, he always used to forget his cell, but those days are gone. What he's doing these days isn't quite the same as carrying a badge, but it's not bad. In fact, it's pretty good. Most of the fish Finders Keepers nets are minnows, but today's is a bluefin tuna, and Hodges is stoked. He's looking at a big payday, but that's not the main thing. He's engaged. That's the main thing. Nailing bad boys like Oliver Madden is what he was made to do, and he intends to keep on doing it until he no longer can. With luck, that might be 8 or 9 years, and he intends to treasure every day. He believes Janie would have wanted that for him, too. Yeah, he can hear her say, wrinkling her nose at him in that funny way she had. Barbara Robinson was also nearly killed 4 years ago. She was at the fateful concert with her mother and a bunch of friends. Barb's was a cheerful, happy kid then, and is a cheerful, happy teenager now. He sees her when he takes the occasional meal at the Robinson home, but he does that less often now that Jerome is away at school. Or maybe Jerome's back for the summer. He'll ask Barbara when he talks to her. Hodges hopes she's not in some kind of jam. It seems unlikely. She's your basic good kid, the kind who helps old ladies across the street. Hodges unwraps his salad, douses it with locale French, and begins to snark it up. He's hungry. It's good to be hungry. Hunger is a sign of health.
2. Morris Bellamy isn't hungry at all. A bagel with cream cheese is the most he can manage for lunch, and not much of that. He ate like a pig when he first got out. Big Macs, funnel cakes, pizza by the slice, all the stuff he had longed for while in prison. But that was before a night of puking after an ill-advised visit to Senor Taco in Lowtown. He never had a problem with Mexican when he was young, and youth seems like just hours ago. But a night spent on his knees praying to the porcelain altar was all it took to drive home the truth. Morris Bellamy is 59, on the doorstep of old age. The best years of his life were spent dyeing blue jeans, varnishing tables and chairs to be sold in the Waynesville outlet shop, and writing letters for an unending stream of dead-end Charlies in prison overalls. Now he's in a world he hardly recognizes, one where movies show on bloated screens called IMAX, and everyone on the street is either wearing phones in their ears or staring at tiny screens. There are television cameras watching inside every shop, it seems, and the prices of the most ordinary items, bread, for instance, 50 cents a loaf when he went up, are so high they seem surreal. Everything has changed. He feels glare blind. He is way behind the curve, and he knows his prison-oriented brain will never catch up. Nor his body. It's stiff when he gets out of bed in the morning, achy when he goes to bed at night, a touch of arthritis, he supposes, after that night of vomiting, and when he wasn't doing that, he was shitting brown water. His appetite just died. For food, at least. He has thought of women. How could he not, when they're everywhere, the young ones barely dressed in the early summer heat? But at his age, he'd have to buy one younger than 30, and if he went to one of the places where such transactions are made, he would be violating his parole. If he were caught, he'd find himself back in Waynesville with the Rothstein notebooks still buried in that patch of waste ground, unread by anyone except the author himself. He knows they're still there, and that makes it worse. The urge to dig them up and have them at last has been a maddening constant, like a snatch of music. I need a lover that won't drive me crazy, that gets into your head and simply won't leave. But so far he has done almost everything by the book, waiting for his P.O. to relax and let up a little. This was the gospel according to Warren Duck Duckworth, handed down when Morris first became eligible for parole. "You gotta be super careful to start with," Duck had said. This was before Morris's first board hearing and the first vengeful appearance of Cora Ann Hooper. "Like you're walking on eggs. 'Cause see, the bastard will show up when you least expect it. You can take that to the bank. If you get the idea to do something that might get you marked up on doubtful behavior, that's a category they have. Wait until after your P.O. makes a surprise visit. Then you'll probably be all right. Get me?" Morris did. And Duck had been right.
3. After not even 100 hours as a free man, well, semi-free, Morris came back to the old apartment building where he now lived to find his P.O. sitting on the stoop and smoking a cigarette. The graffiti-decorated cement and breeze-block pile called Bugshit Manor by the people who lived there was a state-subsidized fish tank stocked with recovering druggies, alcoholics, and parolees like himself. Morris had seen his P.O. just that noon and been sent on his way after a few routine questions and a see you next week. This was not next week. This was not even the next day. But here he was. Ellis McFarlane was a large black gentleman with a vast, sloping gut and a shining, bald head. Tonight, he was dressed in an acre of blue jeans and a Harley Davidson t-shirt size XXL. Beside him was a battered old knapsack. "Yo, Maury," he said and patted the cement next to one humongous haunch. "Take a pew."
"Hello, Mr. McFarlane."
Morris sat, heart beating so hard it was painful.
"He's just a doubtful behavior," he thought, even though he couldn't think what he'd done that was doubtful. "Please don't send me back, not when I'm so close."
"Where you been, homie? You finished work at 4. It's now after 6.
I stopped and had a sandwich. I got it at the Happy Cup. I couldn't believe the cup was still there, but it is."
Babbling, not able to stop himself, even though he knew babbling was what people did when they were high on something.
"Took you 2 hours to eat a sandwich. Fucker must have been 3 feet long."
"No, it was just regular ham and cheese. I ate it on one of the benches in Government Square and fed some of the crust to the pigeons. I used to do that with a friend of mine back in the day, and I just, you know, lost track of the time."
All perfectly true, but how lame it sounded.
"Enjoying the air," McFarlane suggested. "Digging the freedom. Is that about the size of it?"
"Yes."
"Well, you know what? I think we ought to go upstairs, and then I think you ought to drop a urine. Make sure you haven't been digging the wrong kind of freedom." He patted the knapsack. "Got my little kit right here. If the pee don't turn blue, I'll get out of your hair and let you get on with your evening. You don't have any objection to that plan, do you?"
"No."
Morris was almost giddy with relief. "And I'll watch while you make wee-wee in the little plastic cup. Any objection to that?"
"No."
Morris had spent over 35 years pissing in front of other people. He was used to it.
"No, that's fine, Mr. McFarlane."
McFarlane flipped his cigarette into the gutter, grabbed his knapsack, and stood up. "In that case, I believe we'll forego the test." Maury gaped. McFarlane smiled. "You're okay, Maury. For now, at least. So what do you say?"
For a moment, Morris couldn't think what he should say. Then it came to him. "Thank you, Mr. McFarlane."
McFarlane ruffled the hair of his charge, a man 20 years older than himself, and said, "Good boy. See you next week."
Later in his room, Morris replayed that indulgent, patronizing good boy over and over, looking at the few cheap furnishings and the few books he was allowed to bring with him out of purgatory, listening to the animal house yells and gulps and thumps of his fellow housemates. He wondered if McFarland had any idea how much Morris hated him, and supposed McFarland did. "Good boy. I'll be 60 soon, but I'm Ellis McFarland's good boy." He lay on his bed for a while, then got up and paced, thinking of the rest of the advice Duck had given him.
"If you get the idea to do something that might get you marked up on doubtful behavior, wait until after your P.O. makes a surprise visit. Then you probably be all right."
Morris came to a decision and yanked his jeans jacket on. He rode down to the lobby in the piss-smelling elevator, walked 2 blocks to the nearest bus stop, and waited for one with Northfield in the destination window. His heart was beating double time again, and he couldn't help imagining Mr. McFarlane somewhere near.
McFarlane thinking, "Ah, now that I've lulled him, I'll double back, see what that bad boy is really up to."
Unlikely, of course. McFarlane was probably home by now, eating dinner with his wife and 3 kids, as humongous as he was. Still, Morris couldn't help imagining it. "And if he should double back and ask where I went, I'd tell him I wanted to look at my old house, that's all. No taverns or titty bars in that neighborhood, just a couple of convenience stores. A few hundred houses built after the Korean War, and a bunch of streets named after trees. Nothing but over-the-hill suburbia in that part of Northfield, plus 1 block-sized patch of overgrown land caught in an endless Dickensian lawsuit."
He got off the bus on Garner Street near the library where he had spent so many hours as a kid. The lib had been his safe haven, because big kids who might want to beat you up avoided it like Superman avoids kryptonite. He walked 9 blocks to Sycamore, then actually did idle past his old house. It looked pretty run down. All the houses in this part of town did, but the lawn had been mowed, and the paint looked fairly new. He looked at the garage where he had stowed the Biscayne 36 years ago away from Mrs. Muller's prying eyes. He remembered lining the second-hand trunk with plastic so the notebooks wouldn't get damp. A very good idea, considering how long they'd had to stay in there. Lights were on inside number 23. The people who lived here, their name was Saubers, according to computer research he'd done in the prison library, were home. He looked at the upstairs window on the right, the one overlooking the driveway, and wondered who was in his old room. A kid, most likely. And in degenerate times like these, one probably a lot more interested in playing games on his phone than reading books. Morris moved on, turning the corner onto Elm Street, then walking up to Birch. When he got to Birch Street Rec, closed for 2 years now due to budget cuts, a thing he also knew from his computer research, he glanced around, saw the sidewalks were deserted on both sides, and hurried up the rec's brick flank. Once behind it, he broke into a shambling jog, crossing the outside basketball courts, run down but still used by the look, and the weedy, overgrown baseball field. The moon was out, almost full and bright enough to cast his shadow beside him. Ahead of him now was an untidy tangle of bushes and runty trees, their branches entwined and fighting for space. Where was the path? He thought he was in the right location, but he wasn't seeing it. He began to course back and forth where the baseball field's right field had been, like a dog trying to catch an elusive scent. His heart was up to full speed again, his mouth dry and coppery. Revisiting the old neighborhood was one thing, but being here behind the abandoned wreck was another. This was doubtful behavior for sure. He was about to give up when he saw a potato chip bag fluttering from a bush. He swept the bush aside, and bingo, there was the path, although it was just a ghost of its former self. Morris supposed that made sense. Some kids probably still used it, but the number would have dropped after the wreck closed. That was a good thing. Although he reminded himself, for most of the years he'd been in Waynesville, the wreck would have been open. Plenty of foot traffic passing near his buried trunk. He made his way up the path, moving slowly, stopping completely each time the moon dove behind a cloud, and moving on again when it came back out. After 5 minutes, he heard the soft chuckle of the stream, so that was still there too. Morris stepped out on the bank. The stream was open to the sky, and with the moon now directly overhead, the water shone like black silk. He had no problem picking out the tree on the other bank, the one he had buried the trunk under. The tree had both grown and tilted toward the stream. He could see a couple of gnarled roots poking out below it and then diving back into the earth, but otherwise it all looked the same. Morris crossed the stream in the old way, going from stone to stone and hardly getting his shoes wet. He looked around once. He knew he was alone. If there had been anyone else in the area, he would have heard them, but the old prison peak was second nature. And then knelt beneath the tree. He could hear his breath rasping harshly in his throat as he tore at weeds with one hand and held on to a root for balance with the other. He cleared a small circular patch and then began digging, tossing aside pebbles and small stones. He was in almost halfway to the elbow when his fingertips touched something hard and smooth. He rested his burning forehead against a gnarled elbow of protruding root and closed his eyes. Still here. His trunk was still here. Thank you, God. It was enough, at least for the time being. The best he could manage. And, ah, God, such a relief. He scooped the dirt back into the hole
and scattered it with last fall's dead leaves from the bank of the stream. Soon the weeds would be back. Weeds grew fast, especially in warm weather, and that would complete the job. Once, upon a freer time, he would have continued up the path to Sycamore Street because the bus stop was closer when you went that way, but not now, because the backyard where the path came out belonged to the Saubers family. If any of them saw him there and called 911, he'd likely be back in Waynesville tomorrow, probably with another 5 years tacked onto his original sentence, just for good luck. He doubled back to Birch Street instead, confirmed the sidewalks were still empty, and walked to the bus stop on Garner Street. His legs were tired, and the hand he'd been digging with was scraped and sore, but he felt 100 pounds lighter. Still there. He had been sure it would be, but confirmation was so sweet. Back at Bugshit Manor, he washed the dirt from his hands, undressed, and lay down. The place was noisier than ever, but not as noisy as D-Wing at Waynesville, especially on nights like tonight with the moon big in the sky. Morris drifted towards sleep almost at once. Now that the trunk was confirmed, he had to be careful. That was his final thought. More careful than ever. 4. For almost a month, he has been careful. Has turned up for his day job on the dot every morning and gotten in early at Bugshit Manor every night. The only person from Waynesville he's seen is Charlie Roberson, who got out on DNA with Morris's help, and Charlie doesn't rate as a known associate because he was innocent all along, at least of the crime he was sent up for. Morris's boss at the Mac is a fat, self-important asshole, barely computer literate but probably making 60 grand a year, 60 at least. And Morris? $11 an hour. He's on food stamps and living in a ninth-floor room not much bigger than the cell where he spent the so-called best years of his life. Morris isn't positive his office Carol is bugged, but he wouldn't be surprised. It seems to him that everything in America is bugged these days. It's a crappy life, and whose fault is that? He told the parole board time after time and with no hesitation that it was his. He had learned how to play the blame game from his sessions with Curd the Turd. Copping to bad choices was a necessity. If you didn't give them the old mea culpa, you'd never get out, no matter what some cancer-ridden bitch hoping to curry favor with Jesus might put in a letter. Morris didn't need Duck to tell him that. He might have been born at night, as the saying went, but it wasn't last night. But had it really been his fault? Or the fault of that asshole right over yonder. Across the street and about 4 doors down from the bench where Morris is sitting with the remains of his unwanted bagel, an obese baldy comes sailing out of Andrew Halliday Rare Editions, where he has just flipped the sign on the door from open to closed. It's the third time Morris has observed this lunchtime ritual, because Tuesdays are his afternoon days at the Mac. He'll go in at 1, and busy himself until 4, working to bring the ancient filing system up to date. Morris is sure the people who run the place know a lot about art and music and drama, but they know fuck all about Mac office manager. At 4, he'll take the crosstown bus back to his crappy ninth-floor room. In the meantime, he's here, watching his old pal. Assuming this is like the other two midday Tuesdays, Morris has no reason to think it won't be. His old pal always was a creature of habit. Andy Halliday will walk, well, waddle, down Lacemaker Lane to a cafe called Jamais Toujours. Stupid fucking name. Means absolutely nothing, but sounds pretentious. Oh, but that was Andy all over, wasn't it? Morris's old pal, the one with whom he had discussed Camus and Ginsberg and John Rothstein during many coffee breaks and pickup lunches, has put on at least 100 pounds. The horn rims have been replaced by pricey designer spectacles. His shoes look like they cost more than all the money Morris made in his 35 years of prison toil, but Morris feels quite sure his old pal hasn't changed inside. As the twig is bent, the bough is shaped.
That was another old saying. And once a pretentious asshole, always a pretentious asshole. The owner of Andrew Halliday Rare Editions is walking away from Morris rather than toward him, but Morris wouldn't have been concerned if Andy had crossed the street and approached. After all, what would he see? An elderly gent with narrow shoulders and bags under his eyes and thinning gray hair, wearing an El Cheapo sport jacket and even cheaper gray pants, both purchased at Chapter 11. His old pal would accompany his growing stomach past him without a first look, let alone a second. I told the parole board what they wanted to hear, Morris thinks. I had to do that. But the loss of all those years is really your fault, you conceited homo cocksucker. If it had been Rothstein and my partners I'd been arrested for, that would be different. But it wasn't. I was never even questioned about Messieurs Rothstein, Dow, and Rogers. I lost those years because of a forced and unpleasant act of sexual congress I can't even remember. And why did that happen? Well, it's sort of like the house that Jack built. I was in the alley instead of the tavern when the Hooper bitch came by. I got booted out of the tavern because I kicked the jukebox. I kicked the jukebox for the same reason I was in the tavern in the first place, because I was pissed at you. Why don't you try me on those notebooks around the turn of the 21st century if you still have them? Morris watches Andy waddle away from him and clenches his fists and thinks, you were like a girl that day, the hot little virgin you get in the back seat of your car, and she's all, yes, honey, oh yes, I love you so much. Until you get her skirt up to her waist, that is. Then she clamps her knees together almost hard enough to break your wrist, and it's all, no, oh no, unhand me. What kind of girl do you think I am? You could have been a little more diplomatic, at least, Morris thinks. A little diplomacy could have saved all those wasted years. But you couldn't spare me any, could you? Not so much as an attaboy. That must have taken guts. All I got was, don't try to lay this off on me. His old pal walks his expensive shoes into Jamais Toujours, where he will no doubt have his expanding ass kissed by the maitre d'. Morris looks at his bagel and thinks he should finish it, or at least use his teeth to scrape the cream cheese into his mouth, but his stomach is too knotted up to accept it. He will go to the Mac instead and spend the afternoon trying to impose some order on their tits-up bass-ackwards digital filing system. He knows he shouldn't come back here to Lacemaker Lane. No longer even a street, but a kind of pricey open-air mall from which vehicles are banned, and knows he'll probably be on the same bench next Tuesday. And the Tuesday after that, unless he's got the notebooks. That would break the spell. No need to bother with his old pal, then. He gets up and tosses the bagel into a nearby trash barrel. He looks down toward Jamais Toujours and whispers, you suck, old pal. You really suck. And for 2 cents. But no. No. Only the notebooks matter, and if Charlie Roberson will help him out, he's going after them tomorrow night. And Charlie will help him. He owes Morris a large favor, and Morris means to call it in. He knows he should wait longer until Ellis McFarland is absolutely sure Morris is one of the good ones and turns his attention elsewhere, but the pull of the trunk and what's inside it is just too strong. He'd love to get some payback from the fat son of a bitch now feeding his face with fancy food, but revenge isn't as important as that fourth Jimmy Gold novel. There might even be a fifth. Morris knows that isn't likely, but it's possible. There was a lot of writing in those books, a mighty lot. He walks toward the bus stop, sparing one baleful glance back at Jamais Toujours, and thinking, you'll never know how lucky you were, old pal.
5. Around the time Morris Bellamy is chucking his bagel and heading for the bus stop, Hodges is finishing his salad and thinking he could eat 2 more just like it.
He puts the styrofoam box and plastic spork back in the carry-out bag and tosses it in the passenger footwell, reminding himself to dispose of his litter later. He likes his new car, a Prius that has yet to turn 10,000 miles and does his best to keep it clean and neat. The car was Holly's pick.
"You'll burn less gas and be kind to the environment," she told him.
The woman who once hardly dared to step out of her house now runs many aspects of his life. She might let up on him a little if she had a boyfriend, but Hodges knows that's not likely. He's as close to a boyfriend as she's apt to get. "It's a good thing I love you, Holly," he thinks, "or I'd have to kill you." He hears the buzz of an approaching plane, checks his watch, and sees it's 11:34. It appears that Oliver Madden is going to be Johnny on the spot, and that's lovely. Hodges is an on-time man himself. He grabs his sport coat from the back seat and gets out. It doesn't hang just right because there's heavy stuff in the front pockets. A triangular overhang juts out above the entrance doors, and it's at least 10 degrees cooler in its shade. Hodges takes his new glasses from the jacket's inner pocket and scans the sky to the west. The plane, now on its final approach, swells from a speck to a blotch to an identifiable shape that matches the pictures Holly has printed out. A 2008... Beechcraft King Air 350, red with black piping. Only 1,200 hours on the clock, and exactly 805 landings. The one he's about to observe will be number 806. Rated selling price, $4 million and change. A man in a coverall comes out through the main door. He looks at Hodges' car, then at Hodges.
"You can't park there," he says.
"You don't look all that busy today," Hodges says mildly.
"Rules are rules, mister."
"I'll be gone very shortly."
"Shortly is not the same as now. The front is for pickups and deliveries. You need to use the parking lot."
The King Air floats over the end of the runway, now only feet from Mother Earth. Hodges jerks a thumb at it. "Do you see that plane, sir?" The man flying it is an extremely dirty dog. A number of people have been looking for him for a number of years, and now here he is.
The guy in the coverall considers this as the extremely dirty dog lands the plane with nothing more than a small blue-gray puff of rubber.
They watch as it disappears behind the Zane Aviation building. Then the man, probably a mechanic, turns back to Hodges.
"Are you a cop?"
"No," Hodges says, "but I'm in that neighborhood. Also, I know presidents." He holds out his loosely curled hand, palm down. A $50 bill peeps from between the knuckles.
The mechanic reaches for it, then reconsiders. "Is there going to be trouble?"
"No," Hodges says.
The man in the coverall takes the 50. "I'm supposed to bring the navigator around for him right where you're parked. That's the only reason I gave you grief about it."
Now that Hodges thinks of it, that's not a bad idea. "Why don't you go on and do that? Pull it up behind my car, nice and tight. Then you might have business somewhere else for 15 minutes or so."
"Always stuff to do in Hangar A," the man in the coverall agrees. "Hey, you're not carrying a gun, are you?"
"No."
"What about the guy in the King Air?"
"He won't have one either." This is almost certainly true, but in the unlikely event Madden does have one, it will probably be in his carry-all. Even if it's on his person, he won't have a chance to pull it, let alone use it. Hodges hopes he never gets too old for excitement, but he has absolutely no interest in okay corral shit. Now he can hear the steady swelling beat of the King Air's props as it taxis toward the building. Better bring that navigator around, then.
"Hangar A, right. Good luck."
Hodges nods his thanks. "You have a good day, sir."
6.
Hodges stands to the left of the doors, right hand in his sport coat pocket, enjoying both the shade and the balmy summer air. His heart is beating a little faster than normal, but that's okay. That's just as it should be. Oliver Madden is the kind of thief who robs with a computer rather than a gun. Holly has discovered the socially engaged motherfucker has 8 different Facebook pages, each under a different name, but it doesn't do to take things for granted. That's a good way to get hurt. He listens as Madden shuts the King Air down and imagines him walking into the terminal of this small, almost off-the-radar FBO. No, not just walking, striding, with a bounce in his step, going to the desk where he will arrange for his expensive turboprop to be hangared. And fueled? Probably not today. He's got plans in the city. This week, he's buying casino licenses. Or so he thinks. The navigator pulls up, chrome twinkling in the sun, smoked gangsta glass reflecting the front of the building, and Hodges himself. Whoops, he sidles farther to the left. The man in the coverall gets out, tips Hodges a wave, and heads for Hangar A. Hodges waits, wondering what Barbara might want. What a pretty girl with lots of friends might consider important enough to make her reach out to a man old enough to be her grandpa. Whatever she needs, he'll do his best to supply it. Why wouldn't he? He loves her almost as much as he loves Jerome and Holly. The four of them were in the wars together. That's for later, he tells himself. Right now, Madden's the priority. Keep your eyes on the prize. The doors open, and Oliver Madden walks out. He's whistling, and yes, he's got that Mr. Successful bounce in his step. He's at least 4 inches taller than Hodges' not inconsiderable 6'2". Broad shoulders in a summer weight suit, the shirt open at the collar, the tie hanging loose, handsome chiseled features that fall somewhere between George Clooney and Michael Douglas. He's got a briefcase in his right hand and an overnight bag slung over his left shoulder. His haircut's the kind you get in one of those places where you have to book a week ahead. Hodges steps forward. He can't decide between morning and afternoon, so just wishes Madden a good day. Madden turns, smiling.
The same back to you, sir. Do I know you?
Not at all, Mr. Madden, Hodges says, returning the smile. I'm here for the plane. The smile withers a bit at the corners. A frown line appears between Madden's manicured brows.
I beg your pardon?
The plane, Hodges says. 350 Beach King Air. Seating for 10. Tail number November 114 Delta Kilo. Actually belongs to Dwight Cram of El Paso, Texas. The smile stays on, but boy, it's struggling.
You've mistaken me, friend. My name's Mallon, not Madden. James Mallon. As for the plane, mine's a king, all right, but the tail is N426LL, and it belongs to no one but little old me. You probably want signature air next door.
Hodges nods as if Madden might be right. Then he takes out his phone, reaching cross-draw so he can keep his right hand in his pocket. Why don't I just put through a call to Mr. Cram? Clear this up. I believe you were at his ranch just last week. Gave him a bank check for $200,000, drawn on First of Reno.
I don't know what you're talking about.
Smile all gone. Well, you know what? He knows you. As James Mallon rather than Oliver Madden, but when I faxed him a photo six-pack, he had no trouble circling you. Madden's face is entirely expressionless now, and Hodges sees he's not handsome at all. Or ugly, for that matter. He's nobody. Extra tall or not, and that's how he's gotten by as long as he has, pulling one scam after another, taking in even a wily old coyote like Dwight Cram. He's nobody. And that makes Hodges think of Brady Hartsfield, who almost blew up an auditorium filled with kids not so long ago. A chill goes up his back.
Are you police? Madden asks. He looks Hodges up and down. I don't think so. You're too old. But if you are, let me see your ID.
Hodges repeats what he told the guy in the coverall. Not exactly police, but in the neighborhood.
Then good luck to you, Mr. In the Neighborhood. I've got appointments and I'm running a bit late.
He starts toward the navigator, not running, but moving fast. You were actually right on time, Hodges says amiably, falling in step. Keeping up with him would have been hard after his retirement from the police. Back then he was living on Slim Jims and taco chips and would have been wheezing after the first dozen steps. Now he does 3 miles a day, either walking or on the treadmill.
Leave me alone, Madden says, or I'll call the real police.
Just a few words, Hodges says, thinking, damn, I sound like a Jehovah's Witness. Madden is rounding the navigator's rear end. His overnight bag swings back and forth like a pendulum.
No words, Madden says. You're a nut.
You know what they say, Hodges replies as Madden reaches for the driver's side door. Sometimes you feel like a nut, sometimes you don't. Madden opens the door. This is really working out well, Hodges thinks as he pulls his happy slapper from his coat pocket. The slapper is a knotted sock. Below the knot, the sock's foot is loaded with ball bearings. Hodges swings it, connecting with Oliver Madden's left temple. It's a Goldilocks blow, not too hard, not too soft, just right.
Madden staggers and drops his briefcase. His knees bend but don't quite buckle. Hodges seizes him above the elbow in the strong come-along grip he perfected as a member of this city's MPD and helps Madden into the driver's seat of the Navigator. The man's eyes have the floaty look of a fighter who's been tagged hard and can only hope for the round to end before his opponent follows up and puts him down for good. "Ups-a-daisy," Hodges says, and when Madden's ass is on the leather upholstery of the bucket seat, he bends and lifts in the trailing left leg. He takes his handcuffs from the left pocket of his sport coat and has Madden tethered to the steering wheel in a trice. The Navigator's keys on a big yellow Hertz fob are in one of the cup holders. Hodges takes them, slams the driver's door, grabs the fallen briefcase, and walks briskly around to the passenger side. Before getting in, he tosses the keys onto the grass verge near the sign reading Loading and Unloading Only. A good idea, because Madden has recovered enough to be punching the SUV's start button over and over again. Each time he does it, the dashboard flashes Key Not Detected. Hodges slams the passenger door and regards Madden cheerfully. "Here we are, Oliver. Snug as two bugs in a rug."
"You can't do this," Madden says.
He sounds pretty good for a man who should still have cartoon birdies flying in circles around his head.
"You assaulted me. I can press charges. Where's my briefcase?"
Hodges holds it up. "Safe and sound. I picked it up for you." Madden reaches with his uncuffed hand.
"Give it to me."
Hodges puts it in the footwell and steps on it. "For the time being, it's in protective custody."
"What do you want, asshole?"
The growl is in stark contrast to the expensive suit and haircut. "Come on, Oliver, I didn't hit you that hard. The plane, Cram's plane."
"He sold it to me. I have a bill of sale."
"As James Mallon."
"That's my name. I had it changed legally 4 years ago."
"Oliver, you and legal aren't even kissing cousins, but that's beside the point. Your check bounced higher than Iowa corn in August."
"That's impossible." He yanks his cuffed wrist. "Get this off me!"
"We can discuss the cuff after we discuss the check." "Man, that was slick. First of Reno is a real bank, and when Cram called to verify your check, the caller ID said First of Reno was what he was calling. He got the usual automated answering service, 'Welcome to First of Reno, where the customer is king, blah-de-blah,' and when he pushed the right number, he got somebody claiming to be an accounts manager. I'm thinking that was your brother-in-law, Peter Jameson, who was arrested early this morning in Fields, Virginia." Madden blinks and recoils, as if Hodges has suddenly thrust a hand at his face. Jameson really is Madden's brother-in-law, but he hasn't been arrested, at least not to Hodges' knowledge. "Calling himself Fred Dowlings, Jameson assured Mr. Cram that you had over $12 million in First of Reno in several different accounts. I'm sure he was convincing, but the caller ID thing was the clincher. It's a fiddle accomplished with a highly illegal computer program. My assistant is good with computers, and she figured that part out. The use of that alone could get you 16 to 20 months in a club fed, but there's so much more. 5 years ago, you and Jameson hacked your way into the general accounting office and managed to steal almost $4 million.
"You're insane."
"For most people, $4 million split two ways would be enough, but you're not one to rest on your laurels. You're just a big old thrill seeker, aren't you, Oliver?"
"I'm not talking to you. You assaulted me, and you're going to jail for it."
"Give me your wallet." Madden stares at him, wide-eyed, genuinely shocked, as if he himself hasn't lifted the wallets and bank accounts of God knows how many people. "Don't like it when the shoe's on the other foot, do you?" Hodges thinks. "Isn't that just tough titty?" He holds out his hand. "Give it."
"Fuck you."
Hodges shows Madden his happy slapper. The loaded toe hangs down, a sinister teardrop. "Give it, asshole, or I'll darken your world and take it. The choice is yours." Madden looks into Hodges' eyes to see if he means it. Then he reaches into his suit coat's inner pocket, slowly, reluctantly, and brings out a bulging wallet. "Wow," Hodges says. "Is that ostrich?"
"As a matter of fact, it is."
Hodges understands that Madden wants him to reach for it. He thinks of telling Madden to lay it on the console between the seats, then doesn't. Madden, it seems, is a slow learner, in need of a refresher course on who's in charge here. So he reaches for the wallet
and Madden grabs his hand in a powerful knuckle-grinding grip, and Hodges whacks the back of Madden's hand with the slapper. The knuckle-grinding stops at once.
Ow! Ow! Shit!
Madden's got his hand to his mouth. Above it, his incredulous eyes are welling tears of pain. One must not grasp what one cannot hold, Hodges says. He picks up the wallet, wondering briefly if the ostrich is an endangered species. Not that this moke would give a shit, one way or the other. He turns to the moke in question. That was your second courtesy tap, and two is all I ever give. This is not a police and suspect situation. You make another move on me, and I'll beat you like a rented mule chained to the wheel or not, do you understand?
Yes!
The word comes through lips still tightened with pain. You're wanted by the FBI for the GAO thing, do you know that? A long pause while Madden eyes the slapper, then he says yes again. You're wanted in California for stealing a Rolls-Royce Silver Wraith, and in Arizona for stealing $500,000 worth of construction equipment which you then resold in Mexico. Do you also know those things?
Are you wearing a wire?
No. Madden decides to take Hodges' word for it.
Okay. Yes. Although I got pennies on the dollar for those front-end loaders and bulldozers, it was a damn swindle.
If anyone would know a swindle when it walks up and says howdy, it would be you. Hodges opens the wallet. There's hardly any cash inside, maybe $80 total, but Madden doesn't need cash. He's got at least 24 credit cards and at least 6 different names. Hodges looks at Madden with honest curiosity.
How do you keep them all straight?
Madden doesn't reply. With that same curiosity, Hodges says,
Are you never ashamed?
Still looking straight ahead, Madden says,
That old bastard in El Paso is worth $150 million. He made most of it selling worthless oil leases. All right, I flew off with his plane. Left him nothing but his Cessna 172 and his Lear 35, poor baby.
Hodges thinks if this guy had a moral compass, it would always point due south. Talking is no use, but when was it ever? He hunts through the wallet and finds a bill of particulars in the matter of the King Air. $200,000 down, the rest held in escrow at First of Reno to be paid after a satisfactory test flight. The paper is worthless in a practical sense. The plane was bought under a false name with non-existent money. But Hodges isn't always practical, and he's not too old to count coups and take scalps. Did you lock it up or leave the key at the desk so they could do it after they put it in the hangar?
At the desk.
Okay, good. Hodges regards Madden earnestly. Here comes the important part of our little talk, Oliver, so listen closely. I was hired to find the plane and take possession of it. That's all. End of story. I'm not FBI, MPD, or even a private dick. My sources are good, though, and I know you're on the verge of making a deal to buy a controlling interest in a couple of casinos out on the lake, one on Grand Belle Coeur Island and one on Petit Grand Coeur. He taps the briefcase with his foot. I'm sure the paperwork is in here, as I'm sure that if you want to remain a free man, it's never going to be signed.
Oh, now, wait a minute.
Shut your hole. There's a ticket in the James Mallon name at the Delta Terminal. It's a one-way to Los Angeles. Leaves in, he looked at his watch, in about 90 minutes, which gives you just time enough to go through all the security shit. Be on that plane, or you'll be in jail tonight. Do you understand?
I can't.
Do you understand? Madden, who is also Mallon, Morton, Mason, Dillon, Callan, and God knows how many others, thinks over his options, decides he has none, and gives a sullen nod. Great. I'll unlock you now, take my cuffs, and exit your vehicle. If you try making a move on me while I do either, I'll knock you into next week. Are you clear on that?
Yes.
Your car key's on the grass. Big yellow Hertz fob. Can't miss it. For now, both hands on the wheel. 10 and 2, just like Dad taught you. Madden puts both hands on the wheel. Hodges unlocks the cuffs, slips them back in his left pocket, and exits the navigator. Madden doesn't move. You have a good day now, Hodges says, and shuts the door.